You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the DIY Sportsman Podcast, with your hosts, Garrett Prawl and Boudreaux Boswell. On today's podcast, we're talking with Sean McVay from Sean's Outdoor Adventures on YouTube. Sean has hunted for an extremely long amount of time up in Pennsylvania, and he's been pretty successful there. And just recently, he's done an out-of-state trip to Iowa. And not only that, he's actually got up and moved to Iowa. So now he's an Iowa resident, and he's got the whole last season essentially where he hunted in Iowa as a resident. So now with that experience, both kind of hunting the Pennsylvania public land and now doing non-resident and resident in Iowa, which is, as we all know, one of the most sought after states for whitetails. So we just really wanted to dive in and ask him what his experiences were like, what he thinks East versus West. Is Iowa really worth it for out-of-staters? And to see what he has planned for next year.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause there was a lot that I learned through all that. So there was a lot that surprised me. So yeah, I have a lot of insight that I can give people.
But you are probably most well known for your YouTube channel, which you do kind of similar content to what I do on YouTube. Just a whole bunch of deer hunting content, teaching people how to hunt, how to scout, how to, you know, use equipment, how to read maps, all that good stuff. I'm curious, is the hunting land in Iowa very expensive?
You know what? It's definitely more expensive than I was hoping it would be. So I've been doing real estate searches for the past month or so. And so I'm in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which is eastern side of Iowa for the most part. Like if I drive straight east, I can be in Illinois in about an hour or so, maybe a little bit more. But then, you know, north I have Wisconsin, south I have Missouri. So I'm about 2 hours from Wisconsin, 2 hours from Missouri. So when I zoom out on like Zillow and it has like map view, and I put in like my parameters of what I can afford, there's like three or four dots in all of Iowa that would I could potentially afford. And then there's like all these dots in Wisconsin. Like right now, like as we talk, I could drive two hours and 20 minutes and buy a pretty cool spot in Wisconsin, like with a cabin and like 15 acres for less than the cheapest piece of ground I can find in Iowa. And that's because there's a lot of guys who, even though they can't hunt every year, they're buying up these farms in Iowa. So that drives the price up. And then they lease it to even to hunting outfitters. They'll lease it to them. And then they'll say, when I draw a tag, though, I get first dibs, you know. So now they're making money on – you can make money on this. You can make money on, the, like, the CRP income, or, you know, you rent out the farming. And so you're making income there toward your monthly payment. And then if you're also renting out the hunting rights, you're making money there. And so it's like a super smart investment, and people have caught on to that. I mean, it's, you know, one thing – real estate's one of the best investments out there. It's one that seldom goes down in value. You know, I mean, we had that real estate market crash in 2008, I think it was, but that was largely related to a bunch of bad loans that lenders were writing. Like they were giving loans to people they shouldn't have been, and then people ended up defaulting. And now we had all these homes that were people couldn't pay for. The banks had them all. And it's just like the whole market is just, you know, as long as they are smarter about the loans they're writing, then that protects the real estate market. But we've rebounded. Here we are, you know, we're about a little over 10 years past it. And, you know, we almost forget that happened. So anyway, real estate is a good investment. You want to have a return on your investment, and you want to enjoy it, and you're a hunter. Get some hunting ground, you know, work toward that. You know, that's the way I'm even looking at it. Like if I can get a piece of ground right now and get my foot in the door and then keep rolling it into a bigger investment. Then by the time my kids are in college, you know, you could always sell that piece of ground. The long-term intention is I can enjoy it now and then I'll sell it then. And we'll have their college paid for type of a thing. So it's a good investment.
If you were to buy a piece of land in Iowa, would you see yourself trying to hunt that at least some or exclusively, or would you be trying to lease it out and just kind of use it as an investment while you're?
Well, for me, because I produce hunting videos for, I don't want to say for a living because it's not my primary income right now, but it is, I'm like, you know, realistically, we're semi-professional hunters, you know what I mean? By the fact that we create content that is monetizable and that people are watching and that, you know, brings us income. Yeah. So anyway, for me, one of the reasons I moved to Iowa was for the hunting. And the thing that I found out when I got here, which I was super duper duper excited about, is that as a landowner, you can get landowner tags. So as a resident, I can have a buck tag for archery and a buck tag for gun season. But if I owned my own land that also had at least, I forget what there's like a minimum number of acres that has to be used for farming. Mm-hmm. So if you have a piece of property that has this number of acres that is used for farming, then you can get landowner tags, which means you can get like a buck tag for archery for your property and probably, I think, a buck tag for gun season. So like right now, as you sit here, and we're looking at each other on Skype. So as of right now, I can get two buck tags for the state of Iowa next year. And I also, I'm going to throw this in there. I live in the city, so I did this urban hunt they have in the city this year.
Yep.
And if you get five doe, you qualify for a bonus buck tag the next year, which I did. Thanks be to God. So as we sit here, I can get three buck tags for the state of Iowa next year, which is super exciting. But if I can get this piece of ground, now you're looking at an additional tag or two. And the piece of ground that I'm looking at, no one would want to, like, I can only afford like this 15, 20 acre piece of ground. Like, that's what most of the price range I'm looking at. Mm-hmm. And I have my eye on one right now that's just out of my reach because you have to have a 20% down payment. And it's just, price-wise, it's just out of my reach. So in a couple months, if I keep saving, I might have enough. And if it's still there, I might go for it. So it's basically about 10 and a half acres of woods and about 9.5 acres or so of cropland. And the cropland, I've been researching all this stuff, and they're renting it out for about $200 an acre, roughly. It depends on where you're at. But, you know, so there's an $1,800 for the year if I rented out croplands. And basically, if I can get the property for what I'd like to get it for and do that, I'm really only in it like $300-$400 a month for my part of the mortgage, maybe anywhere between $300 and $500. It depends on what the taxes came out to be and all. But that's manageable, you know. And here you have a property now. You can hunt it and then you got equity, you're growing. And what a lot of people do is they, you know, this is a small farm. What it really is there, you can tell there's like a 100-acre farm and there's a corner over here that has woods. And they're like, a lot of people, you'd be surprised how many people don't hunt out here. So they probably looked at that and like, we don't need that. Let's sell that because somebody will actually use it for hunting and we'll take the money for whatever we need it for. And, you know, we got the 80 acres that we need for farming right here. So mm-hmm. that's all they care about. And so that you can tell that's what this particular property owner did. And, you know, so but anyway, for me, I can get in that, hopefully. And then after like 5 years down the road, when I have a little more money saved up, you can roll that into a bigger farm. You sell it, take the equity, put it down for like, you know, a bigger farm. And you just try to keep stepping up each year. So that's my. I hope that no one from Iowa is listening to this. Because next thing you know, that piece of ground is going to get sold. And I'll be like, ah, I shouldn't have said anything.
Dan Johnson's probably listening to this. He'll take your plan.
Don't do it, Dan. Don't do it.
So I mean, this Iowa move for you is recent, right? You basically spent one full hunting season in Iowa since you've moved here. Is that right?
So I'm going to talk a little bit about what it takes to get a hunting license in Iowa as part of what I want to say here. So I moved here at the end of June because Iowa is a state that is very sought after in our country. and they've had a lot of people try to get in here, buy land, and make it look like they're landowners, or I mean residents, so that they could hunt here every year, but they don't live here. So Iowa did some major cracking down on that over the years. You have to be a proven resident for at least 90 days before you're allowed to buy a hunting license in Iowa if you've ever purchased one as a non-resident. So I did back in, I think 2015 was when I came out. And so I barely got my license. I got my license like a day or two before opening day, you know, which was October 1st. And also being moving out here, taking on a new job, and I didn't have as much time as I would have liked to scout. So I was scouting a lot of the public land. I was running cameras like crazy all over the place. I was surprised at you know, some of the places I was running cameras, I got like so many people. Like, I couldn't believe how many hunters were in this one spot. Like, I was all excited about this spot. I set up all these cameras because I didn't get to go out much. I'm like, I just got to get as much info mm-hmm. as I can. So I set up all these cameras. I go, and the first couple times I checked them, it was just me. But then as we got closer to the season, more and more guys, there were so many guys. And then out here, which is something I wasn't prepared for, they have squirrel hunting open up like right before archery season. I can't tell you how many squirrel hunters were out there with guns banging around. I'm like, this is going to totally mess up the deer. You know, I'm not going to hunt there. I mean, there were so many guys. So some of the spots got ruined because of that. Some of the spots I had hardly any guys. I once in a while would get a guy walking through, but that's that particular spot I'm thinking of, the guy like smashed up my camera, ripped out the SD card. I was like, come on, really? I mean, so there was a little bit of challenge for me. I'm coming into this, you know, I had a lot of hardships that I did not expect. So here's another thing. I'm just going to kind of roll into something Garrett and I had talked a little bit about, you know, beforehand, as far as what it was like coming into this. So I came from Pennsylvania. Literally out my back door was 13,000 acres of public hunting ground. I could walk out my back door and walk for miles, miles and miles and miles through the forest, and it's all public. Here, I live in the city, and anywhere you drive within an hour, there's like they have these tiny pockets of public land. So like, there's one near me that's like 300 acres. There's another one over there that's 50 acres. There's another one over there that's like, they're tiny, and you got all these people going to them. I was just not prepared for the fact that they don't have any real big blocks of public land near me. They actually have one that on paper sounds good. It's like, I forget if it's 10 or 20,000 acres, but it's basically all along this river. So the woods themselves, it's not like you can go deep. You know what I mean? Like, you can park and walk from the parking area all the way through the woods that they have to the river in no time at all. And we had a massive flood this year, so most of that whole ground was flooded out. I mean, there's just a lot of things I was not prepared for. And so the public land was really a bust. I was running into a lot of hunters as well. The beginning of the season, I got out a couple times. I didn't see many people, maybe one vehicle here and there. But as soon as you get close to the rut, the parking lots are filled. I was like, gosh. So I drove. Now, when I came out here as a non-resident, I went to zone 5, excuse me. I've never said that out loud before. I can't believe. Can we delete that? No, I'm kidding. Oops. Anyway, well, that's zone 5 is the zone everybody pretty much wants to go to. I was down there as a non-resident a few years ago, and oh man, I'm about to say something that I'm going to really regret, but I'm going to say it anyway. I came out the third week of November, and I basically had. You have a lot more public land down there, first of all, and I had it mostly to myself. Like, everybody comes out to Iowa, even residents, they go out hunting the first 2 weeks in November, and then by the third week, the hunting activity totally tapers off. So I was here the third week, and I had it like to myself. I had a blast, man. I was passing 130-inch bucks every day, like several, through most of the week of my hunt. And that's something like, if I encountered one in a whole season, close to that size out in the East, it would have been a good season. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, one thing I learned when I came out to Iowa is, you know, Iowa gets this reputation of being a great state, and it is, but where I'm at, there's not enough woods, especially for the public land hunter, to really go for it. You know, so I'm in central eastern Iowa. So if you guys like that zone 7, it's easier to draw a tag for this zone, but unless you're going to go, just stay away from cities at least an hour, because it's just, there's too much hunting pressure. There was a hot second today where I was thinking about, where should I do the map reading challenge next year? And I was like, man, if I have a chance to get all these buck tags, like if I get a piece of property, this year I did the map reading challenge in Ohio, because I was originally going to do it in Pennsylvania before I knew I was going to move. Mm-hmm. And then I felt bad because all the guys who I picked were expecting to do it in PA. I was like, look, the farthest I can drive is to Ohio. And here I am, opening week of the hunting season, leaving Iowa to go to, I mean, Ohio is good and everything, but I'm leaving Iowa. Come on. It was killing me. I hated it. So, and we had an awful rough hunt in Ohio. I mean, it was so difficult where we were at. And I mean, everybody in the state, everyone that hunts Ohio, especially that region, knows that the deer population is just, it's just wiped out right now. And there's just not much there. So, so anyway, it hurt me to do that. And so when I was thinking about this coming year, it's like, man, why leave Iowa again? You know, so I thought about it. I was like, should I just look at, is there any zones where guys could have a chance to draw a tag this year if they applied? And so anyone listening, of course, this is going to make it hard, because if everyone applies, zone 3, there was, I believe it was zone 3. If there was a lot of, there was a, I think they only gave out like 33 tags in zone 3 last year, but 11 of those people had no points. They drew a tag with 0 points, and then the other people that drew a tag had 1 point.
Were those for non-resident applications?
Yeah, for non-resident, yeah. So zone 3 was the northwest corner of Iowa, so that's where that's at. So I don't think there's really anything going on up there as far as population goes. But anyway... I was like, you know, by the time I drive all the way to northwest Iowa, I'm driving so far away from my prime spots anyway that I might as well just – I'm thinking of doing it in Missouri, so I might as well just keep it that. But anyway, so yeah, so if you're somebody listening and you're thinking, I want to hunt in Iowa someday, here's a couple things to consider. If you want to do it yourself on public land, I had a blast in the southern zone, but I will say this. This year I went to the same piece of ground in the second week of the rut, second week in November, and it was crawling with people. There was a truckload of Amish people that got dropped off. I was like, man, I did not anticipate this at all. Like I hiked back in. I was back in about a mile and a half at this spot because there's big enough chunks of woods where you can do that there. I got there. It's actually right where I shot my buck. You guys can see it on my thing because it's back on the wall back there. But I shot my buck in Iowa at this spot the last day I was there, and I saw like a 160 class 10-point chasing does just out of range at that spot. I never got video of him because he was running, and I didn't want to mess it up if he got close enough, so I didn't even play with the camera. And I saw so many shooter bucks from that same area that day, but I was just out of range. So like I went over and found the perfect spot where all the deer movement was, and I found a hang on that it set up. So this year I went in there and I put a hang on in at that spot. And just as I was getting set up, there's like another flashlight coming through the woods. And there was just so many people there. I was surprised. I mean, this year, I saw a decent number of deer that day, but they were all like 2-year-old 8-pointers. There was none of those shooters that I saw a couple years ago were there. But anyway, my point is the second week of the season and the first week of the season, you're going to have guys all over the place, and that just makes it tough. So you want to actually look at what options do you have. I mean, some people don't want to pay for an outfitter, and that's fine. But maybe even look into trying to lease a farm. You know, like I talked about maybe buying a 20-acre farm that's half woods, half farm. But, I mean, there's a lot of apps out there now, Base Map, I think it's called, and Onyx, where you can find out who owns the land. Like, if you zoom in on an area and just find a small farm, you could even try contacting that landowner and say, hey, look, I'm wanting to come for a week. Would you give me, sell me like a hunting lease right for the week or whatever the terminology is, basically. And you might be able to get it for a fraction of what an outfitter is going to charge you. And if you become friends with that landowner, you could say, hey, can you set up some trail cameras for me? Or if I send them to you or that type of thing. I mean, some out here in Iowa, there's so many deer. It's ridiculous. Like, that's another big difference. Like, I mean, there's just deer everywhere. And the trails are so obvious because there's so many deer that even somebody who doesn't hunt could walk out on a piece of property and just see the deer highways and hang a camera up. You tell the landowner, look, go out and get on a beat trail and walk it till you come to an intersection of another one and hang the camera pointed at the intersection. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you'll get plenty of data. So, I mean, those are some ideas for guys who are thinking of doing a hunt. But another big piece of advice, if you want to do an out-of-state hunt on public land, do it early in the season before the deer get much pressure and when they're still on their natural feeding patterns, or do it late in the rut rather than the prime of the rut, you know, because that's when guys stop, when guys give up or guys don't plan their hunts, and the deer aren't being pressured, they get back on their routine. They get back up and move. So I had a blast the third week in November when I was here as a non-resident.
Yeah, I had a similar experience this last fall with southeast Minnesota. We were there early in the season, kind of before anybody was really hunting. I'd say at that time of year, probably squirrel hunters are outnumbering bow hunters maybe 5 or 10 to 1, right? So we were able to actually see quite a few deer. And yeah, even some nice deer that were hitting fields that you wouldn't expect on public land, even, you know, during daylight, came back in the first week of November, which happens to be the first week of the firearm season here in Minnesota. Mm. And it was just, right, as night and day different as you can expect. Mm. That was what we saw. So I can definitely feel you on that one.
Yeah. That's some of the things to keep in mind for people. I mean, and I know we were talking about maybe doing comparisons to East Coast and Midwest hunting. And I mean, I don't know if you have a lot of people listening from the East Coast or not, but I would strongly encourage people who are listening from the East, like, just set your expectations based on what's there, not on what you see on TV or on videos. It really hurts me, like, when I hear people, you know, commenting on videos on mine or sending me emails and talking about, you know, why aren't I seeing bucks like I see these guys on TV or whatever. It's like, well, where are you hunting? You know, like when I would hunt, I grew up hunting Pennsylvania. I spent the last 13 years hunting the northern region mountains of Pennsylvania. And the deer herd is just very low right now. It's really a management thing. So I guess I could talk about this a little bit too. In Pennsylvania, for many years, when I was a kid, they managed the deer by keeping as many deer in the herd as possible to make it fun for hunters. But what happened is the deer wiped out the habitat, like totally wiped out the forest. And when like management started to become a thing, like habitat management and deer herd management, and they started to look at it, they're like, wow, we do this all wrong. So what they did is they wiped out the deer herd. They allowed for all the does to be shot, like over a certain, not all of them, but a large number compared to what used to be shot over a short period of time. And so people went from seeing 20 to 40 deer on a sit to seeing no deer in 3 weeks of hunting. And a lot of people quit. A lot of people gave up hunting. And I came into it right around that time. So I was like, I moved to the mountains because I always heard those stories, you know. And I was like, I want to be able to go out and see deer. And when I got there, they were gone, type of a thing. So it was tough hunting, but that's what made me who I am as a hunter. Like, I will not tolerate going out and not getting deer. So if I would go out, I would say, why? What do I need to do? And I would analyze everything till you know, I was blue in the face. What happened though is I began to find out things and discover things that I never knew were even remotely possible. That's how I learned how to read maps and everything, is just because of me pushing myself to say, how can I give myself more of an edge? And when I began to analyze the topography and where the deer trails were, like, light bulbs started to go off. And I think the very first thing that triggered it actually was, I believe God brings us to talk to people for a reason sometimes in our lives. And one day I had a conversation with this guy who used to hunt right near where I hunted. And he was talking about hunting. He's like, I always sit in this saddle on the mountainside, or on the mountaintop over there, or it's actually a ridge. So there's a saddle in this ridge. And this is probably like 15 years ago. And I just had moved to the mountains, and I was like, I don't know what he's talking about. What is a saddle? And he was saying, like, I would sit in that saddle and I'd always see deer, and I would talk to guys who are a few hundred yards away and they would see nothing. And the light bulb didn't even go off right away until like a year later. I was hiking across that ridge and I finally realized what he meant by the saddle, you know, that dip in the ridge.
Yep.
And I'm seeing these deer trails go through the saddle. And then just another light bulb goes off, like, wow, you know, deer, especially in this area, that the food is scarce. We're not in cropland area here. It's all about survival. And that also includes, preserving energy in the wintertime. Like, how can I get over this mountain with the least amount of energy expenditure? And that's what deer do by habit, by nature, in so many situations. And so I just started to pick apart the topography and analyze it from the sense, what will give the deer the biggest advantage for this or for that? What would give the deer the best advantage in the rut? You know, and I would see these benches were starting to pop out and be in hot spots in the rut. And so I went from seeing no deer, you know, over like a month to, you know, harvesting four deer in a season and things like that. And it was just because it wasn't because there was more deer, is because I was pushing myself and gaining, you know, edges that I didn't have before as far as putting myself in spots. And so I read this book a long, long time ago called The Tracker by Tom Brown Jr. I don't know if anybody's ever read that who's listening, but he would talk about this Indian who trained him in the wilderness survival and tracking, and it was grandfather. And they would talk about like oases in the forest that would draw the animals in a sense. Like, that you could have all these dead zones that the deer and animals just don't hang out in those zones, probably because the habitat and the food isn't quite as good there. And there's people that just go wandering all through those dead zones, not even knowing what they're doing. And so I kind of basically, with that concept, I began to hone in on what are the habitat hotspots here. And I began to find them. And it made me a better hunter, and a more successful hunter. But even with all that, I still struggled in a lot of situations just because of the deer numbers being low and the hunting pressure being there. And so in the Midwest, in Iowa, I was shocked by the hunting pressure, and it does hurt the hunting. I hunted a spot on public land this year. I didn't know the spot. I was going in basically blind based on topography alone. But when I got in there, it turned out it was a hot spot. And I saw, like, I got set up in the dark in this spot. I saw probably 5 to 10 deer that morning, which to me is like awesome. Like, wow, I came in blind and I saw 5 or 10 deer. And I heard a huge, you know, you can tell when it's a big deer. I heard a big one walking a trail and making a scrape in the dark. And when it was daylight, I saw a smaller buck walk that same trail and check a scrape like 35 yards from me. There was no shot. It was just so thick. But I was like, oh man, like, I'm in the right area. I just got to move over. But within a week, like, all the hunting pressure came in because the rut was coming in, and I didn't see a single deer in that area. You know what I mean? So even out here, you struggle with that. But I think the deer, because the number of deer is higher, they rebound quicker as well. Like, when the hunting pressure goes down, they get back on their routines before too long. So more so than what I experienced on the East Coast.
Gotcha. When you did your first trip to Iowa, I mean, was that a big eye opener then? I mean, obviously it sounded like you had a really good experience the first time when you went as a non-resident, just kind of traveling, doing the DIY trip. And part of that was because of the week you went. So when you came and started hunting earlier in the season and started to see all this hunting pressure, was it kind of a little bit of a letdown in a sense? You were kind of hoping it might be as good as it was?
Well, yeah, there was a lot of letdowns, actually. First letdown was I didn't realize how little of public land there is across the state. So where I live, where I ended up moving to, it's not like all of Iowa is awesome. So anybody listening, the whole state is not just like awesome for hunting in the sense that there's a lot that's just farmland, and deer can be there during the summer, but they need somewhere to go when the farm crops are taken out. And so there's a lot of the state that is so much all cropland, it doesn't sustain deer year round. And where I live, there's a lot of that not far from the city. It's a lot of the first week I was here, there was a lady at church who I was leading this Bible study, and she's like, oh, yeah, we have a farm. I'm like, whoa, yes. You know, like, how far are you from here? You know, and she's like, yeah, but there's not a single tree on our farm. So I was like, oh, so they got like a couple hundred acres, but it's all crops. And when the crops are gone, the deer are gone. So that was a letdown. And the public land that they do have that's somewhat close, it's hit hard. And then I traveled to the public land where I did well, you know, in the past, and it was still, there were so many guys there that I was not prepared for that. So, you know, if you're public land hunting, you really have to hit it right in order to avoid those pockets of pressure. And when I came out, I got here the weekend that was the end of the second week of November. So when I pulled into the parking lot on public land that weekend, I was coming in blind. I'd never even set foot in the state of Iowa. I just studied the maps and picked out my spots. And I pulled into the parking lot. There were 5 cars in the parking lot. And I was like, oh, this is not good. I hiked back into like a mile to get to the spot I wanted to get to. And there were deer standing at the spot, my waypoint. There was like it was only a small buck with chasing a couple does around. But at least I put myself in the right spot. And it turned out this was another eye-opener. I've been a climbing tree stand guy my whole life, basically. And on the East Coast, you have tons and tons of oak trees that you can just get a climber up in. Yeah, I mean, it's never even a question. Like, you go anywhere you go, you're going to be able to get up in a climber. Here, I could not find a tree that I could use a climber in. I was, like, totally stressing out. It's breaking daylight. And I ended up having to set up like 70 yards from where I had put my waypoint, just because that was the closest I could get in a tree. And I had a guy on, there was like out here, there's lots of draws and little like ridgy type things just from, you know, almost like erosion and like the, what do you call it? The glacier movement back, you know, a long time ago, and rather than having big mountains that you've got to climb up. So I'm at the top of one little like ridge type thing on draws on both sides of me, and I have this guy on the next one over rattling like nonstop, and he's only like 100 yards from me, but it sounds like he's sitting right next to me. And I'm thinking, dude, do you not know what you're doing? I mean, like, people, there's a lot of people who don't know what they're doing, and they come out here and they think they're just going to go out and set up and rattle and they're going to shoot a monster, you know, and that's not good hunting. I mean, you might get lucky, but you got to do best practices, and you got to pay. Like, when I go out hunting, if the wind is not right, I will not touch a call. It doesn't even matter. Like, if there's a chance that the deer are going to be downwind to me when I pick up a call, I will not even do it. I'd rather see no deer and have them not find out where my tree stand location is than try calling, still see no deer, but they alert them that I'm there, you know? So this guy is just going crazy, and I had a buck come literally right underneath me, like an 8-point, maybe like 110-inch 8-point, and the buck just looked over at the guy, you know, rattling like crazy, and then he turned around and walked the other way, you know. So that was the first weekend, though, and as soon as the weekend ended, there was no one. I was the only person there, and I had like I had three big tracts of public land that I was bouncing between, and I was trying to keep all my tree stand locations fresh by not going to the same one 2 days in a row. Even though it's public land, I still try to, you know, do best practices. And I was seeing deer. I was seeing buck every single day. I was passing buck every day. The biggest buck I saw was probably a 170 class public land. I couldn't get a video of him. It drove me nuts. He was about he was probably about 75 yards away from me through, going through the woods, and there was just so many trees and branches in the way. And those of you who film yourself know that it is really hard to find a deer sometimes in that tiny little screen. When you're trying to hunt and you're seeing a giant buck, you know, you also don't want to ruin the hunt. So and during the rut, they're moving. They're on the go. And I saw him moving. I tried to get the camera on him. I just couldn't. But, I mean, profile, if you picture the profile look of a deer, the main beam went past the tip of his nose. He had a really, really long main beam. It was like a picket fence. You know, all the tines were really long, like 10, 12 inches or more of your main, you know, your twos and threes and stuff. And just a lot of everything up there. And I just thought, man, that is probably the biggest buck I'll ever see. At that time, I didn't think I was going to end up moving to Iowa. At that time, I thought that was probably the biggest buck I was ever going to see in the woods. And, you know, so I don't even remember where we started with the question. I just started rambling, and now I'm like, where am I?
It kind of surprises me to hear somebody from PA say that, you know, there's a lot of hunting pressure in Iowa, because every time I look at, like, any YouTube video about PA hunters, you know, they're so much public, so much pressure, you know, and you hear these horror stories come out of Pennsylvania about pressure. And then to hear you talk about Iowa in the sense that it's heavily pressured, surprising to me.
Well, you know, the thing about it is that your public land tracts are not very big. And so, well, where I live, I'm literally in a city. And so you have, you know, I don't even know what the population is here. Let's say it's a couple hundred thousand. You got a couple hundred thousand people and a 300-acre piece of public land 15 minutes away. You know, everyone's going there. So, you know, if you're willing to get away from cities, you're going to be okay. Like, my friend that guides out here in Iowa, my buddy John Ortlieb, his friend moved out here and started a guide business. And so he comes out and helps every year. And for years, he's like, Sean, you got to just come hunt out here. You know, nobody hunts public land. He would drive by the public land parking spots and he'd never see any vehicles. Well, I don't know if it just changed since then or what, if people are catching on, but they get pressure now, you know, during the rut. But not so much. It's only during the rut. You know, I mean, that's when you see all the cars. Nobody really bothers early season. So if you want to get out during the early season, that's a good time. Or after the peak of the rut. You know, most people in their minds, the first 2 weeks of November is the best time to be out. So that's when you're out. So if you get outside of that, it's not too bad. But yeah, that was a surprising disappointment for me, was like not having good public land opportunities that you could get away from people here. You know, like I said, where I was living, 13,000 acres of public land out my back door. I knew I could hunt. I could walk 2 miles and get away from people. And I knew where to go that people wouldn't think to go based on topography. And so I could find my areas that deer didn't see another person that year. But you're not going to find that here. But what you do have opportunities as a resident is, you know, I've had people from my church offer me to hunt. That, like, this guy's like, I got 5 acres here, you can hunt that. I got 10 acres there, you can hunt that. And I hate hunting tiny little pieces of woods. However, you're in Iowa, so your chances of seeing deer and buck are still good. And here's another thing. I'll throw this in. You know, as far as the state of Iowa goes, one thing I've learned since I've been here is you know, southern Iowa is where it's at. Even the residents, like people that I talk to, like when I tell them how I came and I hunted Zone 5, they're like, they just stare at me and go, how did you know to go there? I was like, well, my friend told me. They're like, oh, okay. Because even people who live in Iowa, they travel to southern Iowa to hunt, or they buy land in southern Iowa to hunt. That's where it's at. I mean, Albia, there's that the Albia buck, you know, that's southern Iowa. That's right. I mean, that's right near where I was hunting. I didn't even know any of that going into it, but it's, I mean, there's guys that, my buddy that guides down there, there's people that own land, even the outfitters, they have property off the edges of the public land, and they get trail camera pictures of 200-inch deer on their properties, and very often those deer are bedding down on the public ground and coming off to feed in the crops on their managed land in the evenings. So you can, it's potential that you could shoot a 200-inch buck on public land in Iowa. You just got to do it in the right area. And really, if you want to do it, I would recommend focusing on southern Iowa. Look at where the public land butts up against outfitter land, because that's all managed and they got all the food there. And think about it. No outfitter is going to put their hunter on public land. But I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, but my buddy, the guides, they tracked a deer last year right to a spot I actually hunted here when I did my blind hunt. It's like topography wise, it's like, You drool over it. You're like, oh my gosh, that spot's got to be awesome. And I went in there, and I had a lot of problems getting set up and finding a tree that I could set up in. But and I screwed it all up because of how much noise I made trying to set up. And but anyway, that spot, they tracked a shot deer to that spot, and all the guides looked at each other and said to each other, "Somebody's got to come back here. This is too good to not." I mean, somebody's got to come put a stand here. And they all, like, were scheming, like which one of us is going to do it? Because, I mean, it's really good. So my point, though, is if you really want a big buck, there are spots that can produce on public ground. And I am talking 200-inch caliber, but you got to know where to go. And when you, like, knowing topography is the first step. But then when you go and look at it, you need habitat, too. And some spots have the habitat. And when I say habitat, I mean something so thick that a buck could honker down in that and get big without being shot. You know, that's like a component you need. You need something that they can hide in. And this one piece of public ground had it all.
If you're a resident in Iowa, are you able to hunt any of the zones?
Yeah, you can hunt anywhere. You get a statewide tag for archery and for gun, and you have to, they actually have different gun seasons. See, in Pennsylvania, you buy a gun tag, you can hunt during any gun, the gun season's just like 3 weeks long. Here, they have early muzzleloader, first shotgun, second shotgun, late muzzleloader. So you have to pick which one of those you want going into it. And I don't hunt with a gun. I never even bought a gun. Like, people have given me guns as gift. I have a shotgun because it was given to me as a present. I have a muzzleloader from that whole when I got picked to be on that TV show. They sent me a muzzleloader, that whole thing. So I have a muzzleloader from that. So I'm like, well, I don't have any land of my own. So it's not like I have food sources that I can hunt late muzzleloader. So I not knowing what to do, I picked early muzzleloader. And I got out like once or twice, and I hunted public land, and I would have guys walk right up on me each time. It was frustrating. So early muzzleloader, I didn't sit in any of the other gun season, but people take off work. There's a lot of people that hunt in Iowa that only hunt with a gun. So people that pick early muzzleloader, that's their week of work that they take off. And so there's guys out there all day long, every day, hitting it hard because that's all the time they got. But if you want to try to hunt public land, you know, in like the muzzleloader or any of the gun season, I'm sure you're going to have plenty of other guys in there. And you know, I would get set up, and it was so frustrating because I'm there, and it's cracking daylight, and somebody comes clunking through with a tree stand one morning. He was probably a bow hunter. But he's just clinkety-clankety. I'm like, he pushed deer out. I had deer right near me. And I'm like clicking my flashlight at him. And I could hear him like, ugh, you know. And he just goes clinkety-clankety down through the woods. Just ruined it all. I didn't see a deer after that. So that kind of stuff is, you know, it's legit. It's here too.
Yeah, I think people sometimes get the grass is greener syndrome. And yeah, like you were saying before, I think the micro scale is oftentimes a lot more of something that could be a key factor than the macro scale when people look at like one state being better than another.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing about Iowa is that as far as non-residents go, you're really restricted. So you don't have a lot of people coming in. I mean, like, you know, the Zone 5 that I hunted in, I don't remember how many tags they give out, but I think it's only like 300 tags or something for that zone. So that helps keep the deer there. So, you know, as coming in as a non-resident, you still have a good number of deer. And I mean, like that spot that I hunted where there was five cars in the parking lot, I mean, it's still like a square mile of woods, so you can spread out. But yeah, I would say, you know, don't give up if people are thinking of coming and hunting here. It's still a good option. I just was giving you a worst case scenario, but there's also those same patches of woods you can shoot a 200 inch buck legitimately. So I don't know if I ever finished that thought, but if you look on the maps at the public land and look at where's the crop land and the outfitter land, outfitters are really what you want because they're going to keep standing food. And then you just need to find where they're bedding down at. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because they're going to come bed down. And a lot of those outfitting lands, the deer are bedding down on public ground next to it, where the public ground is. And so you just need to find that travel corridor. So,
when you did the non-resident hunt, how many points did you need to get to finally draw that tag?
I was sitting on 3 points. And so I put in for the tag and I got it. So most people in the southern zone, like zone 5, they're usually typically having 3 or 4 points. My friend who guides down there is under the impression that it's going to get easier to draw a tag. He said there was an EHD or something breakout years ago that knocked a deer herd down real bad. So a lot of people just sat on their points. And then when they started to cash in, it became harder to draw a tag because, you know, they were sitting on more points.
Yep.
And so he's thinking that we're going to start coming back out of that and that you'll be able to. He used to hunt before he guided out there. He used to hunt there every – like he would draw a tag with like 2 points like all the time. So he used to draw, but I don't know. Maybe you just have more people applying nowadays too. Like hunting's a big thing and a lot of people are more into it now and, you know, more into going on big hunts and stuff. So, but yeah, so I was sitting on 3 points and basically like everybody that knows me, as soon as I got this job in Iowa, they all went out and bought a point this year. all my friends are sitting on a points and they're all, it's a little bit of pressure too, because I think they're all expecting me to set them up, which I'll do my best to do, but that's a lot of people I got to deal with, you know, take care of.
They're all expecting 160s or better in 2 years.
Exactly. So yeah, well, I'll do the best I can, but at least there's a lot of deer out here, so hopefully we'll get them on something. But yeah, so all my friends, but I'm in zone seven, like I said, so there's a chance that they'll be drawing a tag in a year or so. And it'll just be a matter of if I can find enough. I'd have to try to find some private land for them, really. And I've got access to some, but I could use a little bit more to, you know, to facilitate my buds.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm used to, well, Bobby and I both are used to just enormous amounts of public, kind of like what you had in Pennsylvania. I mean, within an hour and a half drive, I've got access to probably, well, I know well over 50,000 acres between Minnesota and Wisconsin. And then obviously when we're down in Missouri, there's tens of thousands of acres of public that really I didn't think had that much hunting pressure when we were there anyway. So,
yeah.
No, I mean, that whole area and where I was born and raised in Missouri, you know, it wasn't until we hunted public land. We had private that we could hunt on, but we hunted public land pretty much all my life. And it wasn't until I was about 18 or 19 that I actually encountered another public land hunter that I did not know was hunting in the area. And it was mind blowing to me that I run into somebody out there because I'd been hunting it since I was 11 and never seen anybody else, you know, out there. And even when me and Garrett were out there this year, you know, scouted a couple hundreds acres of land and didn't encounter anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking of giving that a try. down there. How'd your season go, Garrett? I tuned into a couple of your videos, but I've been so busy with the move that I haven't really had a chance to do much, check out much.
Yeah, so I ended up shooting 3 deer this year. I shot a doe on opening morning in Wisconsin with a longbow, and then I shot another one in Minnesota, and then I shot that 8-pointer in Missouri hunting with Bobby.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, I saw the one doe shot. And then I think I saw the 8-pointer video as well. So I must have missed the longbow one, because I don't think I saw that one.
Okay.
I've thought about, like, Wisconsin is like my friend Jason Farmer, who I mentioned to you earlier. We've been recording this for a long time, but before, hopefully we'll start after that, because we were just chit-chatting. But I mentioned him then. He was doing some research, and I think Wisconsin has the highest number of Boone and Crockett buck harvests per year or something like that. So I thought about at some point trying to make a trip up there. I'm only like 2 hours from the border of Iowa and Wisconsin, but I just have, you know, having 4 little kids and stuff, it's hard to find time to do much, you know? So
yeah,
it's on my to-do list. I'd like to get up there at some point, but we'll see. So how long have you been hunting Wisconsin?
Oh, since I was able to hunt. I lived in Wisconsin. I lived in Wisconsin in grade school and high school. So that was where I hunted basically until I moved to Minneapolis for college. And even then, I still travel over to Wisconsin to hunt. So I've been hunting for a really long time in various regions.
How far of a drive is it for you to get to Wisconsin now?
To get to the border, it's maybe 35, 40 minutes.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
But then to the places I hunt, it's, you know, between like 45 and an hour and a half, just depending on where I want to go.
Okay. Have you ever seen any you know, Boone and Crockett qualifiers?
Probably not legitimate Booners. I've seen some deer that I would consider really nice, you know, public land deer, like 150 plus.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's like anything. I mean, even in Minnesota, there's a lot of public land around the Twin Cities, and I know of deer that are 160 class plus that are shot on there, even though they get tons of hunting pressure every year.
Yeah. What's the deer numbers like in Wisconsin and in Minnesota? Like, is there a decent number, or is it like, are they scarce? Are they hard to come by? Like, what are you dealing with there?
I think they're fine. You'll find, well, it depends on where you're at. Typically the northern parts of both of those states, people will often kind of tell you that the numbers are very low. I don't spend enough time up there to really be able to tell you firsthand. But the general consensus is the northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin don't have very good deer numbers. But then you get toward kind of the southern and kind of the farmland regions of those states, the deer numbers are pretty high. So it kind of depends on where you're at.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious because, you know, not having time to go up and scout around, I've also been wondering, is it worth it? Like, you know, what are the deer numbers like? I had something unique happen this year. Like, I shot all my deer out of one tree this year, which was like a first. So, but it just kind of goes to show you, it's because I only had a few properties that I could hunt, you know, coming in so late to the whole thing. And I could only get, so I did the urban hunt. I couldn't get any doe tags by the time I could buy my hunt license. They were all sold out. And so I got in on this urban hunt thing that they have a lot of tags. They want to get rid of the deer in the city. So I only had a few properties, and I just ended up getting all the deer out of this one tree. But it just kind of goes to show you there's that many deer. Like in Pennsylvania, if I would have shot a deer out of a tree, the deer, like some of the areas I hunted, they're so skittish and smart that they're like, yeah, well, this is not safe. We're not coming back here. You know, the deer out here are like, where'd Butch go? What was that? You know, it's like this, like you could shoot a deer out of the tree and go back a week later and there's more deer coming because there's just that many deer. So, I don't know. It was a different experience for me.
Yeah, I've got a couple buddies who've been trying to put plugs in my ear for the last several years to start applying for Iowa. And the biggest thing for me has always kind of been like, well, by the time I get, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 or whatever points that I'll take to draw, tack on the cost of a non-resident license, it's like, man, for that same price, I could just drive out to Colorado and get like an elk hunt in.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, it's, Iowa's great, but it is expensive. You know what I mean? And yeah, but I mean, now you know me, so I mean, I could set you up. Everyone, all my other right? friends are kind of like, but yeah, I could help. Yeah, if you wanted. But yeah, I do want to talk to you about like the whole elk hunting thing, because I've been talking to a couple other buddies, and we kind of were forecasting like a 2020 elk trip. Just, you know, public land type thing. I've never elk hunted. It was always like a bucket list thing growing up. Mm-hmm. I never thought it would actually materialize. But now that I'm like halfway there living in Iowa, you know what I mean? It's before it was like driving from PA out to like Colorado. It's like, man, I just don't know if I got it in me. But now it's like, well, I'm halfway there now. So a couple buddies of mine and I, we were just talking about it. We were thinking shooting for 2020, doing an elk trip out there. And but yeah, we haven't done it yet, so I'll have to pick your brain on some of that, like what some stuff that we should keep in mind for getting ready for that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I'll be back out there in Colorado this fall most likely, so
yeah. Now you're doing elk this time, but I know, was it last year you shot a mule deer?
Yep.
By yep. the way, that was really awesome. I took that as like a real providence of God thing. You know, you here you are, you set up the video camera, you're going to get a little like B-roll footage or something, and oh, wait a second, there's a deer. Yeah, it's a shooter.
He couldn't have got any luckier in that. When it was set all, up it was that all, B-roll. It's like it was so perfect, it was staged. It's like, yeah. There's no way. Somebody has to have this deer on a leash and lead it out in front of him when this happens.
God wanted you to have that happen. Deer. That was a God moment in my eyes, man.
Well, what was crazy, too, is when I first saw the deer, I was trying to get a shot at it off camera. I wasn't expecting that it would continue to walk in the frame, but as luck would have it, I never had a clear shooting lane until it wrapped all the way around and it was perfectly aligned in the frame.
Yeah. That's awesome. So was that your first muley?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Cool. I almost went on a muley pronghorn hunt this year. I had a fan reach out to me from Virginia, I think it was. He was going out to Wyoming on a pronghorn and muley hunt. And he's like, look, I could go and pay a guide, or how about I just, you know, pay for your ticket and you come with me and you help me with the whole thing. And I'm like, well, that sounds pretty awesome. We'll keep that on the radar. But then I took this job in Iowa and I was like, oh, I'm sorry, buddy, I can't do it. I mean, I can't take it. I came into this new job and I can't be like, hey, by the way, I need a week off of work here in another month or two. So I had to back out of that. But I almost got a chance to go out, which was pretty cool. But yeah, that'd be something fun, I think, to try at some point.
Oh yeah, that's definitely a great experience and a great trip, even if you end up not shooting anything, which yeah. I mean, you look at the statistics, it's like statistically there's a pretty good chance you won't shoot something. So if you do, yeah, it's like icing on the cake, but it's like even then the experience of being out there and running through the mountains and yeah, all that is great.
I guess is it hard to come by them when you're doing like public land do-it-yourself hunts?
Our experience is that it hasn't been tough to find the elk. The challenge is figuring them out in just right, so short a period of time, right? Like if you lived out there, yeah, you can figure it out. Right. But just the fact that you're basically there, you know, it takes you a couple days to kind of get your bearings. It seems like try to figure out the pattern. You start figuring out the pattern, things move a little bit. You get your scent, you know, in various areas. Yeah. And I mean, you can always kind of like you do with turkey hunting, you might be able to get one to respond to a call and get one to come in. But it's like, if that's not working, you're not hearing any right, bugling or anything, it's like, okay, now you got to figure out the patterns and try and set up, you know, ambush spots on saddles or things like that right, to be able to get some natural movement going by.
Gotcha. Oh, that's cool. Do you have like a standard, like I'll only shoot a bull elk if it's this size or that size, or?
Oh, I'll shoot anything that's legal. Like I said, I almost shot a cow the first, or the second trip that we were yeah, out there. I just didn't feel comfortable with the shot, but I'd have been more than happy to fill the tag on it. Right. A lot of the places too, they have like minimum restrictions. Like the place we were at, I think was a 4-point, basically like an APR, where it had to have 4 points on one side. Mm-hmm. So it's like any legal bull, however old right, that ends yeah, up being.
Yeah. That's, I mean, same with me. Like I mean, antlers are great, but at the same time, like, it's not the end-all, be-all. Like, if I went on an elk hunt, I'd be happy with your equivalent of a teenager. You know what I mean? Not like a big mature bull. I don't, you know what I mean? I'm not picky. I like harvesting things. You know what I mean? If all you do is like watch animals walk by and you're always waiting for the biggest one, it's like, well, that's just, I mean, that's great if that's the way you like to do it, but I'm not that person.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you're traveling out of state and time's limited.
Yeah. 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 I don't worry about it. Some people, it has to be the biggest buck or the biggest bull. I'm not that person. Well, when I go for mule deer, I'm going to set up a camera and I'm going to walk out in front of it. And I want to see if that works for me. Work for you. Well, maybe it'll work for me.
Might as well try it.
Yeah.
Couldn't hurt.
That was so random. That was so random.
It's like if you want to see a deer on your own stand, just make sure you like just take out a sandwich and start eating it. Like that's.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The first deer I ever shot on video was a spike back in 1995. And I mean, going into the season, I was like, I'm only going to shoot like a big 10 pointer or whatever. And this is like, you know, I'm a college student, you know, and I want to be a professional hunter. So I'm trying to make hunting videos. And I'm begging my friends to video me. And by the end of the season, we hadn't even gotten close to getting a deer, you know, on at all, you know. So I was desperate, like absolute desperation. I literally was like, if a fawn walks by me, I will shoot it. I need to get something. And it was like right near the end of the season, we went out and here's the sandwich part. I took out a sandwich. I started eating a sandwich and my buddy's like, a deer, a deer, a deer. You know, he's in the stand on the other side of the tree filming for me. And so I'm like holding this big sandwich. It was a big Kaiser roll with cheese in it, like, because I didn't want anything to go bad. So I just put, you know, cheese. It was like 30 degrees outside, so I figured that'd be okay. So I'm holding this thing. I'm like, where am I going to put this? So I end up putting it on the platform of the stand, not thinking I would kick it off of the stand. But as the buck was – I grunted a few times, and the deer turned and came right towards us. And I'm like – and he was zigzagging back and forth, like left to right. So I'm like, I have my bow pointed off on the left side of the tree, and then he turns and he's going the other side. So I turn around. So I have my bow pointing off the other side of the tree. And this back and forth, and I ended up kicking the sandwich right off of the tree. And it just makes this loud thud. And I'm like, I'm just totally expecting this deer to take off and run. But, you know, it's the rut. So it's a spike. So he's stupid. and he just kind of walks right up to the sandwich. And then he sees the baggie that the sandwich was in. He walks over and he puts his nose in the baggie. And I totally, like, spazzed out in my mind. Like, I thought this deer is going to, you know, snort and run. So I quick rushed a shot. And I missed him. So I didn't even know what happened at the time, but years later I figured it out because I missed another deer in a similar situation. So I'm left eye dominant, and I always shoot. I shoot right-handed, so I always just close. I always just closed my left eye growing up, and in the moment I was so excited, I never closed my left eye. So I aimed with my left eye, and it made the arrow go a foot to the left of where I was aiming. So anyway, that was my sandwich story. There you have it. You said take out a sandwich and a deer will come, and that's what happened.
I wouldn't lie to you.
Yeah, you're right. So everyone listening, just bring a cheese sandwich and you know, take it out when the deer movement is slow.
So yeah. Would it be better to set up B-roll footage of you eating this sandwich?
Yeah.
So you double your chances of this deer coming out?
That's when you want a 10-pointer. You know, that's when you want a big buck. So you do the B-roll and the sandwich, and then you're good. Then you're in the money.
That's why I've never gotten into filming hunts. I just can't. No, too much going on.
It's you know, Garrett, do you ever get sick of it?
Sometimes. I don't get sick. I don't get sick of the filming. I get sick of the setup and just having to deal with all the components and,
yeah,
you know, it's like I can climb a tree and be ready to hunt in 5 minutes, but when dealing with the camera gear, triple that, you know, it's like, and then you gotta take everything back down, hunt in the cold weather, and your fingers get numb, and it gets old after a while. But
I get sick of it. I've thought about just going with the hat camera over the last couple of years, like just leave the camera arm at home, you know. And there was actually a couple hunts, if people watched any of my videos this year, there were a few hunts where it was hat footage only, because I was just like, you know what? I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it today. Like, I only had doe tags left, and I'm like, how many people are going to watch a doe video anyway? You know, so I just like, I would leave the video camera in the bag, put a hat camera on, shoot the deer, pull the video camera out to do the commentary afterwards. Let me tell you how nice that was. You know, just to not have to set up, carry the camera arm, set the thing up, and yeah, it was nice. I could get used to that.
If you look at it, my videos as a whole last season, the hunts that I did shoot deer on, I actually didn't have a single one where I had footage of the shot on the main camera.
Yeah.
So a lot of my shots were on the head cam. And it was like they were close, like 10-yard shots. You do a little crop, they actually look pretty decent.
That doe, yeah.
So it's like, you know, I've kind of had the same thought process as you. Is like, is there a way that I can get decent enough footage that it's not like hurting my video quality significantly, right, but yet it still makes the process easier? So I've been doing some experimenting and buying various cameras to play around with that.
Yeah, what I started to do this year was I have multiple different camcorders, you know, and video cameras and stuff. And actually one of my older ones is pretty small. So I was putting it in my pocket, and if deer were moving, I would take it out and get, you know, using both hands, try to keeping it steady. I'd zoom in, get good footage of it, of the deer. And, you know, as they got closer, I would just kind of put it in my pocket and then turn on the hat camera. And then as far as putting the video together, you know, I could show the footage of the deer. And if I was getting enough footage when they were out but zoomed in, you know, you get a good look at them. And by the time you just splice it all together, it kind of worked, you know. I didn't do that on every hunt, especially as it got colder, you know, when it was like 10 degrees out. And I usually don't put a glove on my shooting hand just because I want to make sure I can feel everything. So if you're holding a video camera with that hand and it's 10 degrees and that camera's cold, I mean, your fingers are numb before long. And then when it comes time to shoot, it's like, now my hand's all numb, you know. So I think earlier in the season, I'll just try to fill all my tags earlier in the season next year.
you say that, but that's seriously, it's like so much easier in early season. Everything is easier. You don't get cold. Well, I mean, I guess the bugs are a little bit worse. That's probably the only negative. Yeah. There's less hunters.
Yeah.
The deer aren't as skittish. Yeah. I like hunting early season.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I'll take that. This year was my first year hunting with a thermocell. On the Ohio hunt, we were so eaten up by mosquitoes that we needed them. I was so glad to have it. But you know what? I had deer going downwind of me. Of course, I was 25 feet up in a tree, but it didn't hurt me, I don't think. I was always worried if the deer would smell that or not, because you can smell it. It puts out a smell. But
how do you think, from your point of view, how has like digital scouting and social media changed how people hunt over the past, you know, your channel's been around for 10 years. How's that changed in the 10 years?
Oh man, digital scouting is the bomb. I mean, it's almost unfair to the animals. Just the fact that you can, you know, look at all the topo and aerial photos, it's so helpful. And even being able to carry GPSs with you, I would be in bad shape if I didn't have my GPS. It's actually sitting right here. So that's just a huge help for the hunter. And then you tack on like social media. Like most of the people that write to me, they didn't grow up hunting. They didn't have anyone to teach them. So they're going on YouTube to just watch hunting videos and listen to people who know what they're doing. And I just get hundreds of emails every year from guys telling me the same thing. Like, I'm so grateful for your videos. I didn't grow up hunting. I didn't have a mentor, and you just really, your videos have helped me so much, you know. So, and I also have people writing to me, sharing me their success stories and the pictures. Like, here's the first buck I ever harvested, and I really attribute it to the videos that I watched on your channel. So there you have somebody, there's so many people writing to me saying that. So there's so many people out there who are growing significantly in their ability to hunt and harvest as a result of social media and things like that. So, yeah, I think it helps a lot of people, and it does make it easier for us. So,
yeah, I think there's a lot of people that talk about the negatives with social media, but like you just said, I think there's definitely been some big positives that have kind of come out of that, this new era that we're in.
Yeah, as far as learning and being able to learn, that's the people I'm thinking of. I mean, what are some of the negatives that you guys think about when you think of social media?
Just like you were talking about with Iowa, the perception that people get of going to Iowa, this is what I'm going to kill. You know, a 170 or better, basically. Yeah. When in all reality, that's not it. I mean, people's perceptions and expectations of going to areas like that is one big one to me.
Yeah, so that's a huge negative, and that hurts your younger people. Like, when I say younger, your people who are newer as well, who don't know the ins and outs of hunting and having the correct expectations. I mean, hunting is hard. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter where you are. Hunting isn't easy. I mean, there's going to be times where it's going to all work out and it's going to seem like, wow, that was super easy. But when you take it collectively, it's called hunting, not killing, you know, because we don't just go out and kill stuff. We go out and we try hard, and there's so many times it don't work out. You know, it don't matter where you are. And I used to guide in Illinois, and the outfitter, it was really good that he would say this. Every year when guys would come in, he'd sit everybody down for an opening talk. He said, "You paid for a trophy hunt, not a trophy kill. You paid for the opportunity to maybe get a shot at a trophy deer. It's not a guarantee." And that's really what it is. Like, even if people, you spend thousands of dollars to go on this big hunt, it's not a guarantee. You know what I mean? You might get a shot at a good one, but it don't mean you will. So, I mean, that's another thing too. For people who are out there who are thinking of doing like an outfitter hunt, you know, those are great and everything. But if you're new at hunting, there's still a lot that is on your shoulders. Like, you got to still do the right stuff in the stand. There's so many guys that go out and just blow their hunts because they're alerting the deer with their calling rather than attracting the deer. They're not paying attention to the wind. The paying attention to the wind is the biggest thing. And if you're a new hunter and you're out, even if you pay $5,000 to go to an outfitter and they're going to set you up in a stand, you still got to do the right thing when those deer are in the area and not alert them to your presence. And there's a lot of guys that go out on these hunts and they just blow it, you know. They don't shoot a big deer because they spook them all, you know. So you gotta work on your skills. It's not just a free-for-all. I think if you really want to shoot a big deer and you want it to be easy, then you need to go to a preserve with a fenced-in area, you know, where you're going to pay $10,000 for an 180-inch buck or whatever they charge. I mean, you're going to pay a ton of money, but people do it. Then you can brag to everybody, "Look what I shot. I'm the mighty white hunter."
That's the only negative I think I've seen with social media, or I guess one of them is, it seems like it gives people more opportunity to be ego-driven when it comes to hunting.
Yep.
Not post a picture of your small buck because you're afraid of getting shamed, or just trying to pass it on a buck with maybe not the ideas of QDMA in mind, but maybe you just want to shoot a big buck just so you can post a picture on Facebook about it.
Yeah. And I watched a video today, and I'm not going to say who it was, but I watched a video today of a guy who was telling the story of his first buck he shot scored like 124, and he was angry because he, you know, his minimum would have been a Pope and Young buck, you know. And this is his first year. His first year he ever shot, he was mad that it only scored 124. And I'm thinking, what a shame. What a shame. You know what I mean? Like, to be so focused on that, you know what I mean? Like, I remember how excited I was when I got my first deer. I didn't care. You know, I thought it was a half rack when it was coming in. I was like, I don't care. I'm shooting it. You know, I want to get this. I want a deer. So, you know, I mean, I think that we have to protect ourselves. You know what I mean? Like, everybody out there, you're a human being, you're influenced by other human beings, and there's certain times influences are good and there's certain times that are not good. And when it comes to hunting, don't let other people's opinions and expectations influence you. I mean, get out there and enjoy it. If you see an animal and it's just you and that animal and you're having a good time and you want to seal the deal with a harvest, then you enjoy that. And you don't let anybody take that from you. And if somebody's going to criticize you, then you kick them to the curb in a sense. You don't let it bother you. You just say, I'm not going to listen to that, is what you say to yourself. And, you know, me as a sort of YouTube personality in a sense, I had to go through my own struggles. Like, I get people writing to me, you know, complaining about the size of the bucks I shoot. And a lot of these people are people who lived in the Midwest or were so caught up in the whole antler thing. Even if they didn't live in the Midwest, they were not living in reality, you know. And I just had to just excuse them from my mind. I was like, I'm not going to let them bother me. I'm going to enjoy my hunting, you know. And if they're going to live in that world, they're the ones who are going to be upset and not enjoying it because they're focused on the wrong things and their expectations are too high, you know. So that's a huge thing for people that are out there listening is like, don't let people influence you to that degree. You know, enjoy your hunting. If you're not enjoying your hunting, then find a different hobby. You know, just go do something else. Save your time. That's my advice.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
I mean, too, it's hunting public land. It's always like, you know, at least amongst public land hunters, it's nice because then people, they lower a certain level of expectations. Oh, it's public land. So, you know, we'll accept a slightly smaller deer then. So that was one of the things that was a bummer for me when I couldn't get much good stuff going on for me on public land this year. It's like, I gotta hunt private land. I'm just forced into it for this year. I gotta get something. All I was seeing on public land were small little four pointers and stuff, you know, as far as that were coming in within range in daylight. I didn't even see a shooter buck on public land this year. I got a few okay ones on trail cameras, but even at that, nothing that motivated me to want to go try to get them. I got like some nines and 8, 9 and 10 point type bucks that were probably 3-year-olds, you know, you're 130 at best. And I just was like, yeah, I'm not going to stress myself to shoot a 130, you know, try to, you know. So, I mean, even though I don't let it be the end all be all, I still have goals I do set and I try to work toward them, but I also don't let it be the end all be all.
Right.
I think the buck I shot this year ended up scoring like 135, which is good. I mean, I was happy with it. I mean, some people were like, oh, don't you wish you shot like a 150? I'm like, well, I have a life. It's not just hunting. I mean, I can't just be in the stand all the time. I got 4 kids. I got a full-time job. For the time I got, I'm happy, you know. I'm happy with the deer.
If you're not happy with the deer, matters.
Yeah. If you're not happy with the deer, then why are you doing it, you know?
So I guess sort of in closing, is there anything that now that you've kind of gone through this whole experience of coming from out east, taking a DIY out-of-state trip to Iowa, and now having lived in Iowa and sort of gone through a whole hunting season, is there anything you would do differently now or that you're planning on doing differently for next year?
Yeah. I mean, my preparation time was limited this year. So I want to try to expand in my preparation time. I want to try to continue to search for some public land that maybe doesn't get as much pressure. So, but I need more time to do that. I just didn't have much time this year to really, check out some different public land areas. I did drive by one during the rut. I was actually one weekend, I just went out driving around on a Saturday during the rut looking to see how many cars were parked in which public land. And I drove by one on that day, at least there was not a single car in the parking lot. So I'm going to have that. That's only I'm going to hurt myself if I say how big that one is. Like, if I give the acreage and people, if anybody in this remote area is listening, they'll be able to, because they post the acreages and you can figure out which one it is. But that particular one didn't have cars there. So I'm going to actually do some more homework there. So anyway, one thing I'll do is I'll put more time in because I'll hopefully have more time. And I am going to look more into some private stuff. I almost kind of hate to say it, but I am, because just, you know, the population size where I live now, it's pretty high, and the public land is pretty low. And, you know, I still want to be able to do some hunting where I'm not overrun by hunters. So I am, that's a new thing. I'm going to be doing some more private land hunting next year. I do want to keep my edge though, when it comes to hunting public land. So I do the map reading challenge every year. I'm going to continue to do that. And that's always public land. So there's going to still be public land, but I do think there's going to have to be, just because of the amount of pressure the public land was getting throughout the best parts of the season where I live, I'm going to look into some more private. And I'm also going to take time off next year during the rut. This was my first year in this job, so I didn't take time off. So I didn't get to hunt that much this year. It was really hard work for me to harvest. I got 5 doe and a buck, but I wanted to get the 5 doe so I could get the bonus buck tag for next year for the urban hunt. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, that was super duper hard to do. Like, I had a real hard time pulling that off. So I only hunted like 1 or 2 days a week, but I tried to bounce around between the spots that I had. I only had like 2 spots. And I tried to just bounce around the best I could, going from one to the other, one to the other. And it ended up being the one spot where I ended up getting all the deer. So it drug out. It was over like a 3-month period almost that it took me to get the 5 doe. Another thing I'm going to do differently for that is I'm going to have more time to try to secure some more properties for that urban hunt. I think I'm going to continue to do that. It was kind of fun, but yeah, so those are some of the things. Just basically more time getting more land up front, and also more time scouting public land up front. Those are the biggest things. I think a lot of people probably do that. And I want to actually go out. The season's pretty much over here where I'm at. I've been meaning to go out and set up some trail cameras now to see if I can get some pictures of buck on public land now that most guys are probably out of the woods. We just got five more inches of snow today, so I'm not sure how soon I'll be able to do that. I might have to wait a little bit. I don't know if that helps. It probably doesn't help anybody, but that's some things I'm going to do differently for next year.
Gotcha. I guess for people who want to, I guess, follow your stuff, follow your journey, look at your videos, learn more about you, where's the best place for people to go?
I have the YouTube channel, Sean's Outdoor Adventures, and Sean is S-E-A-N for the spelling. So I got that. I also have a seansoutdooradventures.com website. You can find stuff through there. Those are probably the two main things as far as the hunting stuff goes. But yeah, if you go on YouTube, that's probably, I mean, I got over 400 videos. So I've actually tried to put them in various playlists, because I think you can probably access most of the playlists. So like videos that are like whatever, like I didn't have a specific thing, I would put them in a miscellaneous playlist. And so there's like probably a ton of videos in there that go back years. You have to check that out. But yeah, YouTube, Sean's Outdoor Adventures. It's probably, I mean, I got over 400 videos. There's tons of videos. I try to set it up in playlists on the main page. So I have one playlist called How to Hunt Whitetail Deer. There's probably like 35 videos on there. Just a little, they're designed to have tips in it for hunting. And then I have another playlist called Hunting Strategies, which is same concept. I was trying to like not overload one playlist. So I kind of just said, let's call it something similar. So there's a bunch of videos on that. And then I have a scouting playlist and a archery tips playlist. So I try to kind of put them in playlists. So if people have a particular topic they're interested in, they can click on and just kind of watch through the different videos. I have a playlist on how-to videos, like various how-to type stuff. So
awesome. Well, we won't take up too much of your time, Sean. We really appreciate you jumping on and having that discussion with us tonight.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah.
And that'll do it for this episode. Make sure to check out the Sportsman's Nation on Instagram. Check it out on Facebook. Make sure to click like, subscribe. There's actually now a Sportsman's Nation YouTube channel. It's got just about 1,000 subscribers as of right now. And in addition to that, of course, I have my own YouTube channel, DIY Sportsman. And Bobby has a YouTube channel as well, Boudreaux Boswell. He just uploaded a few videos. I uploaded a bunch of videos from the ATA show on products that I recently, not necessarily reviewed, but at least overviewed and interviewed the manufacturers of those products. So be sure to check that out as well.